Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Ross Gerber, the co-founder and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Investment Management. He runs a ETF that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange under GK. And yeah, I'm glad and honored to have Ross on the show. How are you doing, Ross?
Good. How are you, Dave?
Yeah. I noticed the last time we talked to my channel was actually almost exactly 1 year ago.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been lots of stuff has happened in 2021 for sure. Just curious, how have you been? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. We had a great year again. Good. You know, I'm super excited with all the challenges our society has faced over the last 2 years that I feel like we're getting through this. And our society has a lot of issues, but I feel like these challenges are what almost needs to happen to make a better world. So I'm hoping that this will ultimately lead to a better world over the next couple of years or so.
Awesome.
So I'm feeling positive.
Great. And I've got some really pressing, urgent topics to talk about. I want to talk about market outlook for 2022. I want to go over some of your top stock picks, talk about Tesla, Bitcoin, crypto a bit. But first, so Elon just tweeted this controversial tweet about a day or so ago. He says that he thinks his gut feeling is there will be a recession in the spring or summer of 2022. But no later than, you know, end of 2023, I'm guessing. So it's a pretty, you know, pessimistic view. What's your take on the market? Do you think there's actually a recession risk for next year at all?
Well, of course, there is under certain circumstances, especially if the Fed comes into play in an aggressive manner in the middle of next year. I think Elon's 100% right. So it's all predicated on interest rates, because the way our economy works today, it's 100% based off basically free money. And so if the government starts charging for money any reasonable amount, all markets, real estate and stocks, will adjust to this. With that, you lose that sort of euphoric positive momentum that you get from rising markets and rising real estate. And then you get a recession because we don't see a ton of stimulus coming from the government over the next year. So if anything, tightening monetary conditions are most likely to produce a recession. And I think that's where Elon's coming from. I have a different view, because I actually think the Fed will not be raising rates aggressively next year because of the weakness that Elon's talking about. So I actually have a little bit more faith that the Fed is really actually really concerned about keeping the economy strong versus worrying about inflation.
Got it. Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. So we've got inflation. You know, I mean, it's just skyrocketing, right? The last CPI index was like 6.8% or so.
Right.
Do you see inflation just radically lowering next year? And is this the reason why you think the Fed won't increase interest rates? Or do you see interest or inflation still strong, but then the Fed just kind of not able to do it because the economy isn't as strong? Like, what's your take? Why won't the Fed increase rates when we have inflation?
So inflation is a byproduct of a growing economy normally. So when you look at America over the last 10 years, we basically grew at 2% with 2% or lower inflation, but basically zero inflation, 0 to 1. So that type of economy it produces wealth inequality, because you have a good enough economy that the good do good, but not a good enough economy that the not so wealthy people can make a lot more money. When Trump came into power, he changed that dynamic by cutting taxes dramatically. And by doing that, he spurred economic growth. There's no question. And those tax cuts are still in our economy today, spurring economic growth. So I think as we move forward, it's super important that we continue to focus on growth, which causes inflation. So inflation is wages going up for the average American. But that's not a negative inflation, because then they have more money to spend. Negative inflation is supply chain, for example. So supply chain is a byproduct of the pandemic and the big extremes we've seen from no demand to enormous demand, you know, in the opening and the closing of our economy, which has never happened in American history. So that's why I think the demand blip is already behind us from Christmas. We're already seeing supply chains smoothing out, because a lot of it is just inefficiency. You know, if you go to a port, you see how it's run, you'd laugh, you know, compared to high-tech business today. And then secondly, the real cost increases were around transportation through energy, and number two, through labor shortages. And labor shortages are really easy to solve through immigration, because there's plenty of people who want to come to America sitting at our borders right now from Afghanistan. I think there's 100,000 people with visas just waiting to get into America. So we can easily solve labor if we wanted to. And energy prices are easily solvable, and the prices have already gone down. But we've been getting gouged by the big oil for a year now. And it's about time the government steps in and starts playing hardball with the oil players, because they're just gouging Americans to pay off their debts. And that's what's going on here with inflation. So if oil prices come down and we let more people into this country, in 6 months to a year, inflation's gone.
Okay. So you think, do you think that will happen? I mean, immigration is tough to change, though.
I think we're going to go through this period of time for the whole next year with elevated inflation rates compared to what we consider normal in a more abound economy, but is actually quite normal in a good economy. Like 2-3% inflation is actually really good, and that's where I think we're going to get to. And rates will have to go up at some point to adjust to this, but I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to worry about that next year. Plus, it's an election year, which causes a lot of uncertainty.
Got it. So you said something. I was watching actually your Meet Kevin interview. I'll link it in the video description below that you did yesterday. You said that if the Fed does a third interest rate hike next year, then you're done. You're pulling out of the market for a year. I mean, are you serious about that?
I'm just too old to fall for the same mistakes that I've made in the past. And one of the biggest mistakes you can make is not looking at history. And the history is really simple. And it's like 100% of bear markets are because of the Fed. So the best case scenario is 94, where they raise just enough to slow the economy, and then the economy takes off again. The worst case scenario, of course, my gardener has to come here and I start leaf blowing. You know, it's like,
actually, I can't even hear it. So just continue.
So the best case scenario would be like 94, where the economy slows down and rates go up, and then they just do it perfectly. That was like Greenspan's miracle, and it led to a great boom. I don't know if this Fed is good enough to do that. So I suspect the Fed rather err towards being not aggressive than being too aggressive. But if they're too aggressive and they raise three times next year, I don't think the market can support a higher rate than 1% on the short term. And so I'll sit out the readjustment to lower PE ratio. So you get higher earnings, but you get a lower PE ratio when rates go up. And so what you get is a market that goes nowhere. And that's most likely the scenario we'll see next year, where we don't make a lot of money in stocks unless you're a good stock picker. It won't be a bad year, I don't think, because I think things will end up being very accommodative. So I think the perception that we're going to see a more hawkish Fed next year is incorrect. I think that they'll be pretty dovish.
I see. Got it. I mean, you were also mentioning that you think we're going to see compressing P/E multiples in the next couple of years. If the Fed is not hawkish, is still supportive of the markets, do you still see kind of the PE multiples coming down and compressing?
Yeah. Because I still think tighter monetary policy is the general theme that we'll see over the next 5 years, 3 years. PE ratios right now are over 20 on past four quarters, but let's say 20 for the next four quarters, which is very high for the markets. And that's really predicated on zero rates. And that's what I'm saying. A normal PE ratio for the markets forward PE should be about 18 to 18 and a half in our valuations. And so if the market corrected 10%, we would be in the right spot. That's the way I look at it. So if earnings beat our estimates, next year could be a great year. So I don't want to say there's no possibility of that. I think there's a good possibility that earnings beats our estimates next year because margins continue to expand. But I also think it's all predicated on monetary policy, honestly. It just is. That's the way markets are. And we've lived on zero interest rates for a decade now. And I don't think we can live without it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's imagine kind of a tightening monetary policy situation next year. Let's say P/E multiples do come down a bit. We already have these high growth stocks that have been hit like 50, 70%. or so. Do you think those stocks can get hit more in this type of environment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kathy Wood better watch out, because I love Kathy, but valuations are valuation. Mm-hmm. So I run a business, and let's say your business takes in $1 million of revenue and makes $100,000 of profit. What I pay for that business is based off my perception of its future. Okay. And that perception of its future is still based around $100,000 of profit. And what I pay for that perception of the future can vary wildly based off my opinion of its future. We've gotten into a world where 20 times sales is some sort of appropriate valuation metric when it's not. Okay. Like in the real world, when you buy a real business, like that $100,000 profit business or that $1 million revenue business, we say the multiple should be 3 to 5, 3 to 6 times revenue for just round numbers. A really good business that's growing like crazy, maybe you pay 10 times revenue. So if you look at your stocks and you're paying more than 10 times revenue for a stock, it better be the best thing like ever, because the valuations are absurd. It's just absurdly high. And so if you look at stocks like, you know, Zoom, which I like, and I love the business, but the valuation makes no sense for where they are right now. NVIDIA is a much better company, and it has a much lower PE. So, you know, our top holdings like Tesla, NVIDIA, and Microsoft are growth companies with amazing earnings growth, but much more reasonable valuations than Zoom and Teladoc, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, Teladoc, yeah, I mean, they're not making much, but I mean, Zoom, their earnings seem to be pretty decent, you know?
I mean, like Zoom.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, okay. So in a compressing PE.
So I hope Zoom goes down. You know, like if Zoom went down 30, 40%, it would be an amazing buy, but, you know.
I mean, Zoom is starting to look like a decent a buy, you know, even right now. We'll see. In a compressing PE environment, what stocks do you think do well? What are you looking at?
Well, there's two areas of the market that tend to do well in these periods that really are my least favorite times, because they're not my favorite areas in the market. The first is financials. You know, I mean, financials are always winners in rising interest rates environments. We don't own big banks because of the ethical issues we have with JP Morgan and Wells Fargo and such. We own Silicon Valley Bank, which is a very unique bank up in Northern California that's almost like a venture capital bank. But financials do very well, regional financials. So we're looking in those areas to try to find any bank that I can morally live with. Financials are really a great hedge in this environment. And then secondly is healthcare, actually. Healthcare is not interest rate sensitive. I mean, obviously, the demand for healthcare is unbelievable. The hospitals are filled. The need for drugs, therapies, monoclonal antibodies, emergency rooms, doctors, nurses, technology. Healthcare is one of the I just continually think like we are so underinvested. It reminds me of 9/11 and the defense industry. And we put trillions into defense post 9/11. And I think the same is going to happen with healthcare. So I think we just added Abbott Labs to our ETF and portfolios. We have a strong position in testing and vaccines and sequencing and genetics. So we're very bullish on healthcare going into next year.
Got it. What do you think about, let's say, like a Tesla stock, how kind of vulnerable or influenced do you think Tesla will be by a tightening monetary environment? Do you think there are some risks in 2022 for a stock like Tesla?
Well, I'm very happy to say that Tesla doesn't need to borrow money anymore. So, you know, that makes it better for them that they're actually paying down debt. So higher interest rates doesn't hurt Tesla as far as a business. I think the perception of the stock price, that's where you have the risk. It trades at, let's say, 100 times next year's earnings, you know, maybe 110 times, but it's growing earnings at over 100%. So Tesla can easily take a hit because of interest rates, but Tesla is an execution story. It's its own story irrelevant of the market. Tesla has so much going on as a business compared to any other company I own, that it's all about execution risk. So we've got 2 gigafactories that are supposed to open, and a Cybertruck and a semi they're supposed to do, and a new Model Y line. And you got demand off the charts for their vehicles. So like getting a new Model Y line up is like crucially important. So I think the first half of Tesla's 22 is going to be really hard for them, as it always is. You're scaling gigas and you're scaling production lines at the same time, and two of them. So, you know, Elon, it's never good enough to do one at a time. Let's do two gigafactories. Elon just will take any challenge on. It's insane. But that's why I love him. And I think he succeeds second half of 22. We look at Tesla probably launching a few Cybertrucks out the door, new Model Y lines, open factories, scaling productions in Europe and in Austin. The Austin operation I'm so bullish on, I can't even tell you. Like, Fremont is so inefficient, and to rebuild a new attempt at this, and this is what Tesla's been talking about, is efficiency. And what they're building in Austin and Berlin is even better than China. So, and China's been killing it. You know, like, the factory in China is doing so well. And thank you, Chinese people, for your amazing effort at Tesla. You know, they've done such a good job in China. You know, the quality of the vehicles is great, the amount of production and the speed. So I'm super bullish on Tesla. 22, 23, you know, the only issue is execution risk, which they always have, and they will have bumps in the road. Just expect it. That's Elon. And the thing I care and worry about the most is Elon's health. Okay, we're both 50. I work out a lot more than Elon. I'm in much better shape than Elon. And I took a change in my mentality a year ago of like, I have to think sustainably to myself. It's not just about work. I want to do this for another 25 years healthily. And the stress that he goes through is 1,000 times my stress. So that's the thing we worry about. I was a big investor in Apple for a long time. I never thought anything would ever happen to Steve Jobs, you know? So I just, you know, hope he hears this. Take care of yourself, Elon. Please, buddy. You're doing a great work. Our society needs you. There are very few innovators like Elon that have ever existed. And so, you know, we got to care for him. We don't need another Howard Hughes, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. Hey, so for your GK fund, your ETF, I noticed that Tesla is your top position.
Yeah.
But what you've got about, is it 8% of your fund in Tesla?
Yeah.
Do you have any restrictions on why it's only 8%? Why, you know, can you make it higher or what have you done?
Yes and no. Yeah. I have restrictions that I've used as an investor, which is I try not to have any position over 10%. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And that's also the way diversified funds are sort of required to have. I don't have to be a diversified fund. I could just change my perspectives and be all in on Tesla. But there's a reason. As much as I'm bullish on Tesla, I've been managing money my whole life. The way we manage money is not for maximum return, like Kathy. So the way Kathy looks at money is like maximum innovation, maximum return. I'm going to get you 40% a year if you buy my fund today. That's what she's saying. Okay. That scares me. You know, like that's an absurd 5-year return potential that nobody's ever done in history, really, unless they've been super lucky. And like when you look at long-term track records, 20% a year is an amazing long-term track record that almost nobody has had. I would love to achieve that. You know, that's what I'm trying to do. But what we try to do is try to do it smoothly. That's the challenge. So we have to maintain diversification to do it smoothly. Now, Tesla, as much as I love the stock, I owned it at $7. It's $1,000 today, let's say. Okay. I hate to tell you this, but it'll grow and it'll be an amazing position over the next decade for sure. And I don't even know how much it'll grow, but it'll beat the markets for sure. But I have to find the next thing. And what Tesla did was they started the advancement of sustainable transportation. So what I'm spending most of my time today is finding the other investments. Maybe it's not going to be a Tesla, but they could still do amazingly well because the valuations are so low, like in a stock like Polestar, which has all the potential to be a great EV company. Now, once again, nothing's going to be Tesla because it's Elon. But Polestar is a company we've started investing in because they actually can make and deliver great EV vehicles. And we think this EV business is just going to explode over the next decade. So who are the next players? Lucid Rivian haven't put a car out yet. So they got the valuations, but they haven't gotten the production. Polestar doesn't have the valuations, $20 billion company, but they're getting cars out the door. So I like Polestar. I like battery producers. You know, I was reading about this company called Northvolt. Northvolt is a private company in Sweden that is the best battery up-and-coming company out there. Like, I wish I could buy stock in it. Bally Gifford owns part of it. It's a private company, and I can't get in because I'm a public shareholder. But this company is going to do amazing. So battery technology, all across Asia, there's opportunities in these areas.
Can you buy like a stock like CATL, like on the Hong Kong exchange or something?
Well, no. See, like we can't buy those stocks easily So we had to do it through a fund, LIT, which is the Lithium and Battery Technology Fund from Global X, which is in my fund. You know, I hate having to own a fund in my fund, but it was the only way to get exposure to CATL. And it has Panasonic and it has SK Innovation. There's a little Tesla in there. And then they've got like a bunch of lithium producers like Albemarle and stuff. So like lit is a, it's been a great performer for us. But like when you think about extrapolate out returns, the next real wave are all the suppliers to the EV transportation opportunity. So Tesla's a core holding at 8%. It's a really big weighting for us, but it's also played out a lot, you know, so the future is still very bright. But I like to find the $10, $15 stocks that become $100 stocks. It's hard to buy the $1,000 stock that get it to go to $10,000.
Yeah. You know? Like what kind of companies, like, okay, do you have any company or let's say one or two companies that you think can do a possible 10X, let's say in 5 years or so? You mentioned Polestar's at 20 billion. Can they
have them more at 3 to 5X. Yeah.
3 to 5X.
Polestar is like a 3 to 5X in 3 to 5 years, which is a really good return for us. Mm-hmm. You know, like we have to make like 10X returns are like the A+, you know, like if I can get a 10 bagger, I'm like super happy. So like where are companies that are reasonably valued that have enormous potential growth? You know, and that's always in a few sectors, technology being our number one sector. I think climate is an opportunity. There's so many companies that will do 10X in climate, whether it's in infrastructure, batteries, somewhere. So that's where we're spending a ton of time. I think healthcare, as I said before, with Corona, biotech advancements, and the need to advance our healthcare, I think there will be some huge winners in genomic research, healthcare. I think chips. The demand for chips continues to be off the charts. I think there's winners in here and innovation here with technology, you know, chips and servers and such. So NVIDIA is our second position. Yeah. NVIDIA, I still think could do another 3 to 5X pretty quickly under certain circumstances.
In biotech, is there any company that sticks out that you're most interested in?
Well, see, the problem is I'm not a biotech guy. So that's the problem. I'm a tech guy. So when I look at biotech, I don't have an advantage like I do with technology. So I've stuck with the winners that I have always, like TMO, which is like a top holding in our fund. Thermo Fisher just wins, you know. We have our best bet for real return is Fulgent Genetics. Fulgent is a testing company, and it's a ridiculously cheap testing company. It trades at some absurd multiple because everybody thought Corona was going to go away, but it's not. And then they have a traditional genomic testing business, which is growing like crazy. So they're making like fortunes off Corona and then reinvesting it in genetics. But the valuation is just wrong on this company. Fulgent is a great play that I think I can make really good returns on. And then Moderna, you know, like everybody looks at Moderna as just a vaccine play, and they're missing that the people at this company are genius, like Elon Musk type geniuses. And there's a great book that I'm reading right now, just started, about the people who founded Moderna, and, you know, by Isaacson, who's now writing the book on Elon. So it gives you an idea. If Isaacson's writing a book about you, you're probably pretty smart, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and so I think Moderna is absurdly cheap for its long-term potential. And I don't think vaccines are going away anytime soon. And I think the rest of the world we'll need many more vaccines as we get through this Corona over the next 3 to 5 years. So, so that's where we've stuck with, is bigger players. So I'm not as much as picking the real small player that may hit or miss. That's not my thing.
How about NIO or XPeng, these Chinese automakers? What are your thoughts on their potential?
So I think their potential is large, so I don't want to discount it, but part of the way I make money is through my relationships and knowing more than other people through my relationships. And my relationships in China are nothing like my relationships in Fremont. You know, I can drive up to Fremont and, you know, go talk to people in 5 hours. And China isn't as open to my style of research, which is very prodding. Okay. So if I went to NIO and they opened the doors to me like Tesla does, I would ask all the hard questions to them and I would expect answers. And I don't think I would be welcome. Okay, so I'm sure these are maybe good investments, but I can't do the due diligence the way I do them. And if I can't, I can't put, you know, I'm a 2.5 $3 billion firm now. So any investment I make that's going to matter starts at like 20 million, you know? And so like, if I'm going to put $20 million into a company, but I can't get a CEO to meet with me and really talk about the company, but I can go to Polestar and talk to the CEO. They like couldn't have been more open. I talked to everybody, like everybody. And I'm like, this is awesome. I'm going to invest a few million in Polestar and see how it goes, because I talk to everybody and I love the people involved. So if Neo, if they'll open the doors, let me ask all the questions. I'm happy to look at the stock more. But right now, China is a very closed environment and they're very, very threatened by people like me who ask lots of very difficult questions.
Got it. How about Palantir? Do you have any thoughts on Palantir?
I do. I think it is literally the worst company in the world, like ethically. So like ESG, I have my own ESG rules. You know, everybody can make what they call morality up. I don't really believe in religious morality, for example. So I invest in cannabis. I invest in gambling. I don't listen to people telling me what's moral or not. Okay. But I have certain moralities, like tracking everything Americans do and selling that to the highest bidder, even if they're enemies of America. Now, Palantir and the president of Palantir is basically the for-profit CIA. That's what Palantir is. So over the last 10 years, and it was kind of founded through the Mercer family and the whole misinformation campaigns that brought Trump into power. So Palantir's roots are in tracking all of our digital histories, making profiles. So they have a profile on every American. So they have your profile and everything you do, and they track everything you do digitally, and they do it through nefarious means. And then they take these things and they sell them to companies and governments and foreign spying institutions. And there are no ethical boundaries at Palantir who they will and won't sell information to. So to me, they make Facebook, which I hate, look like Boy Scouts, you know, like that's their business. So I'm glad the stock hasn't gone anywhere. The insiders at CARP has sold over $1 billion of stock. They're cashing out on the public. That's what's happening. Yeah. And so like, why would you want to be a shareholder of a bunch of shady CIA dudes who are cashing out on you, who don't give a fuck about you at all? You know, like if you think they care about shareholders, you're smoking serious weed. Okay. But I can tell you the weed companies care about shareholders, and that is where I'm going to make 10x over the next couple of years, is in the very, very cheap cannabis MSOs, which we haven't talked about, but everybody sold their cannabis MSOs because they didn't get legalization this year. But I think something's going to happen next year, and these stocks are cheap and they make cash and nobody's quitting cannabis. So, you know,
Okay. So
Palantir, no interest.
So I want to talk about cannabis, but before that, so on Palantir, Palantir might say that, hey, they don't really, you know, hold the data or sell the data. They're just servicing their clients, you know, the government. The governments own and collect the data, hypothetically.
Isn't that what the German soldier said when they were burning people? that Hitler, they were just doing a job. They had no idea that they were burning humans.
So here's the other side. Palantir also will say that, would you rather have a government that does their own, let's say, data analysis, and it's under closed doors, and you have a lot more abuses, and it's not even, let's say, I don't know, or would you rather have a government that actually is held more accountable by having outside vendors provide, let's say, data analysis and services where—
How is accountability created?
Because they can't do things that are against the law, because they have a third party outside company actually, you know, involved in the data, let's say, analysis. So let's say if it was completely closed doors, then you would have more of the snout and, you know, things happening, right? Because there's no accountability.
So let me give you an example. Like you live in Bulgaria, and the Bulgarian Secret Service hires Palantir to do an analysis of social media in their country. And what they want to do is they want to figure out who's reading the most articles that are against the Bulgarian government. So they get this third party data. Oh, who exactly is going to keep the Bulgarian government? Now, if you know how they treat people in Bulgaria who don't follow what the government says, It's horrendous human rights abuses going on right now. Okay. Palantir would have no problem selling them this data. Where's the accountability? Is Palantir going to go to Bulgaria and be like, sorry, you're using this to torture dissidents. You can't have our data anymore.
I mean, I think Palantir first, they don't go to, they're not servicing any country that's not aligned with, let's say, the US or Western countries.
How do we know?
That this is part of their mission. They actually want to strengthen Western democracies.
They're full of crap. If a CIA guy tells you something and you just think that's true, you're listening to the fucking worst people in the world. You think that what they're telling you is true?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that is not the way the world works.
Yeah.
The way the world works. People die every day. They're tortured and murdered right now in Hong Kong. Right now. They shut down the pro-democracy paper. They jailed all the pro-democracy journalists. Who do you think gives them this information? Now, in China, they got their own.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? Well, so this is just the Chinese version for profit. That's all it is. So don't be confused where this data is being used at all. It's for oppression. It's not for our benefit. You think governments get up in the morning and think, what's the benefit of the people? That's not the way governments work anymore. It's to the benefit of the people running it.
Yeah. I mean, I used to have a hypercritical view of Palantir, a lot of because of the reasons that you're listing. But then looking more into the company over the past year or two, I'm just seeing a different side. I'm not making conclusions per se, I'm just saying that, I mean, they're claiming, you know, they're not, you know, selling data. They're not the ones collecting data. They're not, you know, and there's a flip side where they're saying that, would you rather have a closed government, you know, that does all this data, you know, surveillance on their own versus, you know, more of an open system?
Well, they all do that, and then they have Palantir to supplement all their data. But nobody's paying Palantir the big dollars that they're getting paid because the data is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So that's why they make the money.
Yeah.
Because they know more.
Well, Palantir also argue that it's not they're not bringing the data, they're bringing the analysis, the AI kind of analysis.
Right. Like these are the specific people you need to jail if you want to stop dissent. So they just give you the full analysis of where your problems are. Trust me, companies do this too, and they hire, I'm sure Facebook hires Palantir to go through all their Slack messages to see who the problem employees are. And then they pull up all the data on the problem employees and the demos, and they're like, oh, we won't hire people from Seattle anymore or whatever, you know? The way it works, man.
Got it.
The world isn't so nice.
All right. So I want to talk about cannabis for a quick sec. So what's your top cannabis pick? Is there any one company that you think that might stick out?
Right now, the one I like the most is Green Thumb. You know, Green Thumb and Ben Kovlar, who runs it, the guy is solid. They've got a great business. He's kind of a winner. You know, he comes from the alcohol roots. You know, his family was part of the Jim Beam family, and he's built a really solid business, and the valuation's very good. The other company that's a little bit has more issues is TerrAscend, which I really like. TerrAscend and Jason Wild, who runs that company, is very good. They bought Gage Cannabis in Michigan, which is a great company, and they're going to dominate the Michigan market, but they've picked really great markets to be in. So I think those two are my sort of favorite picks in that space. But we're well diversified among all the MSOs right now. Mm,
got it. Okay, cool. And then Bitcoin and crypto. So if we have a tightening monetary environment over the next, let's say, year, and let's say Bitcoin and crypto are kind of, you know, they're sensitive in investing instruments, right? What do you think? What's your prospects for crypto in 2022?
So one of the reasons Bitcoin is successful is because of inflation, and because if you put your money in a bank, the bank won't pay you interest and won't loan you the money to buy a house. So what's the utility of a bank or holding cash? There's negative utility because you're losing a lot of money. So it's makes much more sense to own Bitcoin. But if the government reverses this, pays people interest, you know, starts lending money for reasonable rates, and like all of a sudden inflation comes down, maybe the dollar has more value and I don't want to take risk in a risk asset. Like Bitcoin is really a risk asset. You know, people buy it when they're feeling bullish and they sell it when they're scared. Yeah. And so there's that. So the Fed raising rates and tighter monetary policy is not good for Bitcoin, But there's a bigger macro trend that supersedes all of that with digital assets. And that's why we're in it. The macro trend is so big, and it's so, it reminds me very much of Tesla years ago when nobody was buying EVs. There were no EVs to buy, and Tesla was making the S, and now the 3 was coming out. That kind of reminds me where Bitcoin is. So adoption from the public of Bitcoin is still like 99.9% of people don't have Bitcoin. But every day we have deposits coming in from digital assets or cash that people want to convert to digital assets at my firm. And we've built a very safe way for people to buy Bitcoin who don't have tech experience. See, most Bitcoin adapters are people who get tech, you know, and they can download Square and they can buy Bitcoin or download Coinbase or and that's young people. But when you're talking about a 55-year-old client who wants to buy some Bitcoin, they're scared to put $100,000 into Coinbase and buy it. So we've created a program for it. But what we've seen is almost 100% of clients want to diversify into it. And when there is an ETF eventually, when the market makers start trading Bitcoin, because that's why there's no ETF, because Citadel can't make money on it yet. So when Citadel starts trading Bitcoin, and then there'll be market makers that trade Bitcoin, and then there's an ETF, and the public can treat it like an asset class like gold, I mean, Bitcoin could easily double. So that's our premise, that digital assets are the future. The modern banking system is an antiquated piece of crap, and JP Morgan and Wells Fargo are not the future. When you think out 10 years from now, and in my fund, Square, PayPal, and Coinbase are the future. That is banking of the future. And JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Chase, and Citigroup are the past.
Yeah. I noticed you're bullish, it seems like, on Coinbase, but your fund, I mean, you only have like a little less than 2% in Coinbase. Right, is there a certain reason?
Well, we've been accumulating Coinbase, and it's been extremely volatile. So I tend to buy it on the days it gets hammered. So Coinbase is my favorite play in that space more than Square, even though I like Square and it's a little bit more solid of a company. It's bigger. So I'm super bullish on Coinbase. So the issue is it's very hard to quantify what their numbers are going to be, you know, over the next 12 months. I still think the stock's cheap. So when Coinbase gets beat up a little bit, I buy it. FinTech's been hammered at the end of the year here, and it's caused a little bit of underperformance for me. But we haven't changed our position in FinTech. We'll probably be adding to it in Q1.
Got it. And then I noticed you've tweeted about being bullish on Roblox.
Yeah.
In your fund, though, you're only about 1.4%.
Yeah, 1.5 weighted. I added to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so what's going on? How bullish are you? Are you looking to increase that position?
Yeah, so when we accumulate stocks, we don't do it all in one day. And there's a lot of reasons for that. We dollar cost average into positions, so we can try to take advantage of volatility. So when I build a new position, I'll take a small initial position. And then like in Roblox's case, it dropped down at 100 the other day, so I bought a little more. So we like to buy the dips, basically. So I never make an absolute decision where I'm just going to add a 2% position, 2% today, switch all this money around. I don't do that. I tend to move out of position slowly and into position slowly and build them. And it also helps confirm my theses. You know, I would rather build a rising position, actually. So if it's a little rocky for a little bit of time, that's fine with me because we're accumulating shares. And so maybe we learn more about the premise, we see more. Sometimes we're wrong. And if the stock's going against us, then we can exit without losing too much money. You know, like with Beach Bodies this year, we were wrong about, and we were able to exit because we didn't really buy a lot. And then it didn't work and we got out. We didn't lose much. You move on, you know.
Yeah. And also,
Roblox, I'm building that position.
Yeah. Another advantage of just slowly building positions, you learn as you build, you know, as you grow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you can, you're more motivated also, you know, to do your due diligence.
And like you might like an idea and want to own it, but you're not ready to put like the full boat into it. So it's like, I want to own this, but I want to own it and work, you know, and learn. Sure. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So for GK or ETF, your top holdings are Tesla at 8%. You have NVIDIA at about 5.3%. Microsoft is at 4.6%.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a monster. They're just like killing it.
They're doing so well, man.
Yeah, it's like...
You know, it was new management that started this. You know, Nadella is a genius. But so Microsoft's in gaming, which is sort of why I love Microsoft, because, you know, Windows and Teams, and these are It's kind of like Google, where they're established businesses that make tons of money, but they don't excite me that much. But then you go to gaming and you look at what Xbox business is doing. And then you look at assets like Minecraft, which are just like gold mines, you know, and then you look at the metaverse and you start. Now there's this term for gaming called the metaverse, which makes it sound more legitimate than being a gamer. But that's what it is. It's we're building this connection between the digital world and the physical world. And many of us live in both of those worlds. And I game a lot and I love gaming. And so it's like as technology shifts, we've seen this like we discussed Zoom, where we were able to bridge my physical business now with the digital world. And we're busy as ever and we're more efficient as ever because of this. And I think this is what's happening in the real world in many businesses. The bridging of technology or the using or adaption of technology because of coronavirus. I have this new thing I've been talking about how coronavirus is one of the best things that's happened for business. And people are like, what? And I was like, well, think about all the companies that didn't adapt technology. It was like Y2K. This is like Y2K again, where everybody had to upgrade everything because they thought their computers were going to die, you know? And now with Corona, everybody had to adapt technology or they're not going to survive. You know, so this has been, you know, a hugely positive thing for tech innovation and adoption. And yeah. So that's sort of my thing, whether it's FinTech or Roblox or Microsoft, they are like the linchpin of this, just like Apple.
Yeah. Yeah. And with their Azure, you know, web services too, Microsoft is just.
Yeah. And then they've got LinkedIn and they got the whole like business and hiring business. And Teams, they've integrated really well. You know, they had tough competition with Zoom and Salesforce. So at my company, we use Microsoft, but we don't use Teams. We use Salesforce and Slack is integrated. And then we use Zoom, you know. And so when you start thinking about your systems, you've got Microsoft, Apple, right? Yeah. You've got Google, you've got Zoom. And that's, I think, the argument for Zoom, because I think that's a permanent sort of part of the business ecosystem.
Yeah.
And Salesforce, which is like, we've implemented a super complex version of Salesforce in my company, and it's amazing. It's amazing, you know? Yeah. So, you know, we try to be as high tech as possible with using these things, and I'm very bullish on their futures.
Got it. So a few more of your top positions. Number four is LIT, L-I-T, which is the lithium ETF you mentioned.
We talked about that.
Number five is Apple. We just mentioned that. Number six is Lennar and L-E-N.
Yeah, home builders.
The home builders. And number seven is Home Depot.
Home Depot.
I mean, there's such a shortage of housing.
Homes.
Yeah, and these builders just have so much demand everywhere.
It's unbelievable.
Any house they build, you have like lines of people waiting, you know?
So you're in Austin.
Yeah.
The hottest real estate market in the country. Yeah. Okay. It's crazy what's happening there.
Yeah.
Because you also have room to build in Austin, like you don't in LA. And so like builders like Lennar are going into places like Austin. And the biggest challenge is getting land now and then supply chain, right?
Yeah.
And labor. And they're building houses and they literally closed the sales offices because they don't need them. People will just buy the houses. They don't need salespeople. Okay. So they've like cut their costs on sales. And then what happens is they're not even putting the houses for sale early, because the longer they hold the house, the more profit they make. So when the house is done, they put it up and they sell it. And what's crazy about it is we're still not building enough houses in 21 to meet the demand for houses in 21.
Yeah.
So home builders need to ramp up, but they can't because of the supply chain. And people have changed their lives forever. And Austin is a perfect example of this, where I think behavior has permanently changed. Nobody, like I was in New York City and I was like, why would anybody live here? It's literally the worst place in the world. And I love New York and I love New York. But to live in Manhattan makes no sense. The whole purpose of it was because you were by Wall Street and the whole thing, and everybody was there. And now they're all in Miami and Austin and Bahamas or whatever, Puerto Rico. You know, I'm hearing people go, let's go to Puerto Rico. I'm looking at this, I'm going, this is attractive. You know, now I'm in Southern California on the beach, so it's real hard to get me to go anywhere. But when you think about housing in California, there are none. I've been looking for a house for 5 years. When you think about housing in Austin, there are houses to buy. But you will run into no houses probably by the middle of next year. And So you just want to build houses. You want to be Home Depot. So here I have all this technology and climate stuff in my portfolio, and then I have this big real estate section. And that's what makes us different than a lot of other funds, because I actually work with a lot of people in real estate, so I know the business pretty well, actually. And boy, is it a good time. Not all real estate. I don't want to own offices. I don't want to own malls. I own logistics centers, and I own residential construction, you know.
Interesting. Last question. Do you have a Tesla FSD beta?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do.
How long have you had it for? Curious.
I think 2 months, 3 months.
2 months. What's your experience been like? I mean, has it been positive? Do you think they'll reach so-called level four next year, or is it kind of farther out?
So I got full self-driving. I'm famous for having the lowest safety score of all full self-driving beta testers. I have a 37 score. No, seriously, there's articles about this. I am the lowest ranked FSD beta driver in America. So, and my wife, who just walked in, enjoys bringing up that her score is 2.5 times my score. But she has a hard time accepting that I am one of the finest drivers in America, because I'm able to drive the hardest drive in the world the fastest. And so Elon gave me full self-driving, I think, just because my drive is so difficult that if there's so many variables and so many things happen on my drive to work, that if my car can drive to work, they'll have solved full self-driving beta. Now, to this day, I still can't get up the street because there's so much crap, just the construction crap. But when I started with full self-driving beta, I was kind of disappointed. I had to intervene every second almost. It was like, my drive is so hard, it's so dangerous, that I was like, literally, it's like almost dangerous using it, because like, I basically was still driving, you know? So I was like, oh, it's going to take a long time. And then a couple of weeks go by and an update comes, and I was like, wow, that's noticeably better. Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks come by, another update comes. Wow, that's noticeably better. Another couple of weeks, now I get 10.8. 10.8 rolls around, and the car is like, I'm feeling pretty confident making these moves now. And now I'm getting halfway there, you know? Like, it doesn't do the hard part. The first part of my drive is impossible, and then the second part of my drive is easier. Mm-hmm. But it's getting through the second part now. And things that it wasn't able to do just a month ago, it's doing. And now it's doing confidently. It's such a trip. Mm-hmm. The car learns. It really learns, and it learns faster than I thought, and in a meaningfully noticeable way, almost bi-weekly. So I became very bullish on it in the last couple weeks, because all of a sudden the car had more confidence. It was making turns better. It was doing things that were more difficult very easily. And I was like, if this pace continues in a year, we're going to still be sitting in the car, but it'll be like how autopilot is today, where I get on the freeway. I have 100% confidence in autopilot on the freeway. But I don't with full self-drive. So I have to really pay attention to it. But I think in a year, I'll be able to just sit back and put on full self-driving and monitor the driving, but it will drive in LA. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to do it. Mm-hmm. I think he's a genius. I think it's the most consequential software that will save more lives than anything I have seen in software history. Windows didn't save any lives. So maybe the airplane autopilot would be as consequential. Because we used to have accidents all the time before, you know, remember plane accidents? Mm-hmm. So imagine a day where we can say, remember car accidents?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Ross, it's been fun chatting with you on the last day of the year.
Of the year!
Yeah, yeah.
Happy New Year!
Yeah, yeah. Have a great 2022. Wish you all the best. Yeah, I'll go ahead and link to your Twitter profile in the video description, your fund information. Any other places people can find you?
Yeah, GerberKawasaki.com. And we're financial advisors. We're an RIA. So we also help people manage their finances and their financial situation. So if you have any questions about your financial situation, feel free to reach out through GerberKawasaki.com. And you can learn about my fund at advisorshares.com/GK. So that's where you can find me, and on Twitter, which I'm on a lot.
Awesome. Yeah. Nothing we shared was financial or investment advice, because obviously we're not
No, actually, everything I shared was, and I'm actually a financial advisor. Okay, so all the disclaimers are on my Twitter.
Okay. So follow that. Anyways, yeah, wish you guys all the best for those who are watching, and we'll see you all next year. All right. See ya.